Want to cut cooling bills without cutting comfort? Lower utility costs and enjoy cool and consistent comfort with a highly efficient air conditioner from Luxair. With Luxair's consumer rebate program, educators, nurses, first responders, military personnel, and veterans can enjoy exclusive rebates on qualifying purchases of Luxair equipment. To learn more, call G-Team Mechanical at 765-376-3042 or visit gteamhvac.com. They'll recommend a system tailored to your home that provides comfort, energy savings, and lasting performance.
This is Trackside with Kirk Cavan and Kevin Lee on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
Happy April. Welcome. Trackside, 93.5, 107.5 The Fan in Indianapolis. It's not May yet, but it's getting closer. And we will have race cars on track this month preparing for the greatest spectacle in racing. So maybe that's where we start the program with tonight. Next week, activity at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway with the open test on Wednesday and Thursday, April 10th and 11th. And yes, it is a test session, but there's not a lot of practice time, certainly compared to the old days. So we'll call it the month of May and April, beginning very, very soon. We've got that to get into. We've had testing at IMS and other things going on. The gift that keeps on giving is the Thermal Club, with more conversation on that. We've got seats that are still to be filled, not only for the Indy 500, but for other races, and lots of stuff going on tonight on the program. Your thoughts are welcome at KevinLee23, at Kirk Cavan via the Xbox, Twitter, whatever you want to call it. And we've got a guest on the program tonight. Mark Monteith will join us, and I think this is going to be a fun conversation on not a book that he wrote. So first I should explain who Mark Monteith is. By the way, hi, Kurt. How are you?
Good to be with you. It's
did I mention your name? Kurt Cavan.
No,
is with
I don't.
Us. I'm Kevin Lee. Elijah Robertson is in our Indianapolis studio. We're just chatting amongst friends here. So Mark Monteith is a friend of both of ours that we've known for many, many years. Mark worked and wrote for the Indianapolis Star, beat writer for the Pacers. I sat in a lot of press conferences, waited out a lot of Larry Brown and Larry Bird and Rick Carlisle practices with Mark over the years, and he covered everything else, Purdue, IU, a lot of time with you for the Indianapolis Star at the Speedway. Well, he uncovered a manuscript written by Angelo Angelopoulos. Now, I vaguely remember Jimmy Angelopoulos when I was a kid, who was a writer at the Star. Angelo was a writer who passed away way too young in the early 60s. Well, he wrote a book on Bill Vukovic in the late 50s that was never published. Mark found it, finished it up, and it's out now. So we're going to talk with Mark about this book, which I have read about a quarter of in the last couple of days, and I think you finished it?
I haven't finished it, but it's a very difficult book to put down. And honestly, the part about Angelopoulos is as exciting, honestly, as the Vukovic part, at least for me as a journalist in this city. Angelo was a terrific writer. He was a great researcher. He was kind of a man about town. He was trying to think in terms of like our racing circles. He'd be Hinchcliffe. You know, he was just had great personality, or Graham Rahal. Just everyone knew him. He was very talented. He had a way about him. As the great, Bob Collins, who was a writer at the Indianapolis Star, the columnist, once said, Angelopoulos, the older brother, Angelo, was built like a Greek god. And then Jimmy, his younger brother, was a blank Greek. That's what he was, a god blank Greek. So they were complete opposites as individuals. Jimmy was this little guy who actually worked at the Indianapolis News. That's a little different part of the story. Okay. And honestly, Mark Monteith worked at the News as well, came from Fort Wayne. He's an Indianapolis resident. There's a long way to go in this story. The point is, this manuscript was written about Bill Vukovic, and Angelo Angelopoulos had such a great way about him as a writer. And so it really comes through in the book. It's a great read. I appreciate with great, from a historical standpoint, that Mark was able to help uncover this and then to deliver it, because there's a lot of us, you know, we see something interesting as a project that didn't get done, or, you know, something like this that needs to be written. And we think it's interesting, but we probably don't execute it the way Mark did. The other thing to note about Mark is he went to Pike High School. He's an Indianapolis guy, grew up just a little bit north of the Speedway. So he has the racing bug, so to speak. He's just not known to most of us as being a racing writer. But he's an excellent writer. He's written, as you mentioned, covered the Pacers for so many years, has written books about the Pacers. He wrote a great book in the early 90s, may have come out in the late 80s, about Purdue basketball, which is a very good read. I think it's based on the 1988 team, perhaps. It's that era. It's a great book. So Mark's a great writer. And this is an interesting read from the standpoint of, you know, so many of us have grown up knowing about Bill Vukovich. And as, as we know, he was really on pace to do something that's never been done in the Speedway's history, is to win the 500 three straight years. And, you know, the tragic loss, killed in the middle of the race, leading for a third straight victory. It's just a great story. And I really applaud Mark for doing the work, for completing the project. And I just think it has a great historical perspective from the writer standpoint, not Mark's standpoint, but Angelopoulos is an interesting part of the tale as well.
And Bill Vukovich dominated the race in 52, you know, could have won it four straight years. So it's something that, as race fans, we're happy that someone went to the effort for that. It's a labor of love. You know, there's, unfortunately, we hope it's not that case, but it's usually not a huge economic windfall, but we encourage people to buy it because, things like that we need for posterity standpoint. And Mark Monteith went to the effort to do that. So we'll talk with him later on in the show about that. So I'm going to kind of bounce around because there are a lot of things that we want to talk about. Some things from last week we didn't finish up, including on-track activity at Thermal. Let's look ahead to what's coming up in the very near future. I mentioned the test at IMS next week, the 10th and 11th. People have asked me for times. There's probably a schedule somewhere. I even said this, don't worry about making firm plans now. Let's wait until next Monday show. By the way, we're on Monday next week at 7 o'clock. Then we'll have a better idea. My guess is the plan is something like 9 to 5, 10 to six. But even with that, what's the weather? I don't know. But if it's 39 degrees at 9 o'clock, they're probably not going out at 9 o'clock. So it floats. It's 9-ish to 5-ish. And if we get started late because it's wet or cold, then they might run until 6. They might run until 7. So just be fluid, and we will have it on Peacock. What I did also see, so we did confirm, you confirmed, and then others have too, that the mounds are open. And then did I read that they are opening a little bit more of the facility next week?
They are, because the museum area is, you know, under construction to some degree. Actually, I haven't driven past it here in a few days to know exactly what it looks like. It's not a huge change. Obviously, most of the work is being done inside the museum, but they are going to offer some part of the grandstands for viewing. We'll have to see what that exactly looks like. There'll be I'm sure a release comes out later in the week that will detail what plans are in store. We might also add, and I think we can come back to this a little bit, because I think it's part of the schedule as we look ahead to the next week. Next Monday is the eclipse day. And at this point, the Speedway has, you know, made a great push to be open to people. It's going to be, they're selling tickets. And I think they're going to hit 35,000 people, most of whom have never been to the Speedway. They're going to have a lot of activities. If you know, from a learning about the 500 and about IndyCar and racing and motorsports in general. So those people who are coming for the eclipse are really going to get an entertainment from the standpoint of seeing the Speedway and seeing what this sport is all about. So that's Monday. And so that comes before our show. So we'll have to spend some time on Monday just talking about what that experience was like. You know, we'll talk about, Was it cloudy that day? I think we'll all know that at that point. But, you know, that's something that's on the horizon. So Monday, the eclipse portion, you can find all the details if you want to go out to the Speedway on IMS.com. And then we'll have testing on Wednesday and Thursday. So, yes, some grandstands will be available for, you know, I guess unique viewing for oval track. We don't normally have grandstands open, but there will be some.
And I saw that the Today Show will do some things Monday. So I think Lester Holt is going to host NBC News or host. I don't know if he's going to do the 6:30 NBC News from IMS, or maybe it was he was just hosting what NBC News is doing at 2:30 in the afternoon, whatever, it's fully dark. And then I think I read that the Today Show anchors will, you know, be involved in the show from New York. So something is going on. Lester Holt, who is excellent, is going to be at IMS on Monday. And I'm sure that something on the evening news is going to emanate from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And if he's there at 2:30, my guess is that's where he's hosting the evening news that night. They often do that. So that seems to make sense because, yes, they may have a charter, but it's still going to be difficult to teleport him back to Manhattan in that time frame.
Well, wonderful opportunity for the Speedway. And I know when this came up, you know, for discussion, you know, quite a while ago, I remember, you know, there are a few people who thought, well, who's going to pay, you know, anything? Why would you gather at the Speedway? You're going to be able to see this from, you know, your backyard.
And they were on the forefront because everybody's doing it now. Everybody is organizing something.
And so the Speedway staff was terrific to get that ball rolling and to use it. And this is really what I applaud. Not, okay, you got a facility, you can open up the gates, and you can let people come in and you can see. But to capitalize on the opportunity that most of the people coming for this event don't live in Indianapolis. You know, the swath across the U.S. is a very narrow band where the eclipse can be seen. And so for people coming outside, I mean, it's some unbelievable number of states represented that have bought tickets for this thing at the Speedway. You know, it's kind of like when you have the Indy 500 and all 50 states are represented. Now, I don't know that somebody from every state is coming because, again, some of these people can watch it in their hometowns. But to come to the Speedway and to capitalize, as the Speedway has done, to educate people on the 500, on IMS, on the sport in general, great opportunity.
Something else I saw that is coming up. Yeah, it's just a great chance to use the opportunity to introduce them to IMS and the Indy 500. Speaking of the test, I saw this on social media that there is an Indy 500 fan fest next Thursday, the 11th, at the Bottle Works District downtown from 5 until 8. So maybe we'll have a little more details, or maybe you will have a little more detail by next Monday show as to exactly what that is. So that is, after testing is wrapped up, you know, I'm guessing they asked some drivers to come down there and do something. So there'll be, if you're deciding you're coming into town or you just want to kind of make a day of it at IMS, there are all kinds of opportunities. So that is on the horizon. And the other thing I wanted to mention, which maybe I didn't give enough play last week, I think I mentioned it in the last segment because we had a lot to cover, but this is really a pretty big deal. The 100 Days to Indy, Season 1 program debuts on Netflix this Thursday on the 4th. And I don't know what kind of impact it's going to make. I don't know how this works, if it helps, if Netflix, you know, gets behind it. And, you know, it's like shelf space to some extent, I'm guessing, that if the store puts your product out front and center, it's got a better chance to sell. And probably the same thing with Netflix. If they decide that we think this has promise, then we're going to put it in P1 in the just released. And then people are searching for something to see. And then, oh, this kind of looks like Drive to Survive. Let's try this. I've already finished this season of Drive to Survive. So that's my hope. But bottom line, I think it has real promise. Because the reality is, while 100 Days to Indy on the CW was awesome and introduced the sport to some new people, The CW is still, yes, I know it's in 85% of the homes, if not more than that. Maybe it's close to 100%. But you have to do a little bit of searching. And this, I think, has a better chance of people stumbling upon it. So that's my hope, that even a year later makes a little difference, because to these people, they don't know who won the Indy 500 in 2023. So it's all new to them.
Yeah, it's, you know, that first you point out kind of the issue with streaming, and that you just can't, it's a different kind of a promotion, you know, and you have to use your shelf space the way a retail store would use it to, you got to go looking for it, I guess, is in most cases with something on streaming. So yeah, the placement will be important. And then to get to season two later on in the month and see how this develops and see the show as we watch it play out as we roll toward 108th Indy 500.
And Paramount Plus, for our international listeners, that is where you can see season one, I believe, already. But that's available there, and that is not geo-blocked, and that apparently is the best way for those internationally to consume season one. Season two, I believe I saw April 26th.
I think it's the 26th.
Is when that debuts. I know I'm doing another taping with them. And hopefully these will be easier questions this week, because the last round was, tell me what you're thinking June 6th last year. And humana, I got no idea. So that was a rough one. Going through race by race the second half of last season with specific questions. This one should be more about St. Pete and thermal and looking ahead to the Indy 500. I like my chances of having some sort of legitimate answer on that. So that's all good. And I said this too last week. We know the impact that Drive to Survive had on Formula One. I don't think it's coincidence. Well, I'll ask you what you think. NASCAR ratings are generally up. Now, the one from this past Sunday, it was hard to say because last year's race was not a Sunday night race and there wasn't a direct comparison, but most of the races so far have been up, and that has not been the trend in the last few years. And the only thing I can really think of that's different, now maybe you could say Chase Elliott is not hurt, so that could be one thing that hurt them last year, but I don't think it's a coincidence. I'm not going to say it's all of it, but having that show on Netflix is likely helping.
Well, you just stack little pebbles. You know, that's the way I've always thought about it. There isn't one magic, you know, rock out there that you can sit in the middle of the pile and expect it to grow. You've got to stack pebbles. And this is a pebble. It's a little larger than a pebble, these streaming shows. But, I think you're probably like me in that I've heard three or four people that, yeah, they're in tune with motorsports. They certainly, you know, pay attention when it's Indy 500 time, and they know enough about NASCAR to have the lingo. And, you know, they're at least versed in Formula One on a kind of a, you know, low level. But they've watched this show. They've watched the NASCAR show, and they watched the IndyCar show. So, you know, you stack pebbles, and eventually you've got a pile that is significant.
So that's all good. That's stuff that's coming up in the very near future. So we'll keep an eye on that and track how that goes. All right, let's get into some news and some things going on. When we last spoke last week, there was some concern about the future of the Long Beach Grand Prix. And, you know, this has been percolating for a couple of months. All of us in the paddock have been hearing that something's going on, and there are several players for it, and it might be up for sale. And the first thing we saw was a racer story mentioning that NASCAR was potentially going to purchase it. Penske Entertainment was in play. And then one of the things that I mentioned, I don't know how I phrased it on the show, but something along the lines of maybe Jerry Forsyth does this all a solid and helps out because he owns part of it. I didn't know if it was 50%, 49%, 51%, but that was the hope there. And then I know I also said, you know, if it does look like it's headed NASCAR's way, if I'm Roger Penske or Penske Entertainment, I'm thinking maybe I will overpay for this and just understand that I'm going to need to invite NASCAR in to make some of my money back. Well, it seems to be even a better situation, and it does sound like Jerry Forsyth is doing everybody a solid.
Well, it's a great thing that Jerry stepped in and negotiated with the estate of Kevin Kalkoven to acquire the rest of it, and then made the comment that this is an IndyCar race. This is what Long Beach. It wasn't built off IndyCar, but it certainly became IndyCar very quickly in its heritage. Yeah, Jerry Forsyth. I wrestled, for probably an hour after that came out. I just kept thinking, what would that be worth to Jerry? What would he have to pay? He's got obviously a lot of money, but what would you have to pay for that? And why would you buy it other than just to say, I'd like to make sure it stays an IndyCar race. And that's, kind of the heritage from his standpoint, too. So interesting stuff. By the way, as an aside, you made the mention that some people that you knew in the journalism world knew that, what you knew and had heard the things that you had heard. And yet you were surprised that maybe some of these stories hadn't been written yet. So I did speak with one reporter who said, man, I had it all written and ready to go. And just about the time where I was just about to hit post, then Jerry Forsyth's news comes out and I had to redo the 1500 words that I was going to write on this subject. But from a journalist's standpoint, I can tell you, and he thought the same thing, while the frustration of I had done all this work and the story changed on me, at least he hadn't posted it like 10 minutes before the Forsyth news came out.
True.
So at least it came out before he had posted it. And I've had many stories that you start and you've written and you've sourced and you just know it to be one way. And then the story changes and either you look foolish or you get lucky that the news comes out before you post it. So anyway, it's great for Jerry Forsyth from our standpoint. He did us a solid in many respects, and Long Beach can continue as we know it.
What I don't know whether this was in the plans all along or if this was a reaction from Jerry Forsyth hearing the news that NASCAR was about to purchase this, because it happened really quickly. The two stories were separated by about 2 days. And, maybe it was just, let's split it up into two different simple stories. Or did the first story getting out there on Racer provide enough motivation for Jerry Forsyth and saying, no, I'm an IndyCar guy, not a NASCAR guy, and then make the connections with Racer to, let's finish up the story. And I want to make it very clear to anyone that doesn't know the whole story that this isn't going anywhere. So that's a question that we cannot answer, but it is very, very good news on that front. Now, would they consider, does it say in there definitively whether they would invite NASCAR coming in? Because this would still, if I'm Jerry Forsyth and I had to pay significantly, because NASCAR had to offer a lot of money for this. And if Liberty was interested, they might have offered money. Liberty could use it for, I don't think you could use it for MotoGP. They need pretty smooth racetracks, but they've just purchased MotoGP in the last day. But whether they can do Formula One there or not, you would think this would be an asset Liberty would be interested in. So that's my question. Do we know that NASCAR is not going to be included with IndyCar? If they are, by the way, fine. I just want IndyCar to be racing there.
No, I don't think we know that. And there's nothing that would preclude it. You're just trying to make sure IndyCar is there. And if IndyCar is there, let's make it a showpiece. We've talked a lot about venues where IndyCar and NASCAR could share space. The difficulty there is just, the footprint's not huge from the standpoint of bringing in more, the Cup garage and the IndyCar paddock. I mean, it's not a large footprint. There's not a lot of room to move those condominiums. Those restaurants down there by the fountain aren't exactly going anywhere. You're not going to tear down the parking garage. So, there's only so much space. Yes, the sports cars are there, and obviously you've got other support series, but I don't know that it's big enough for IndyCar and NASCAR as we know it.
You could just leave it set up for back-to-back weekends.
You could. I suppose you could.
Run back-to-back weekends. They did something like that with Formula E, did they not? And they had a makeshift track. It wasn't the exact same track that IndyCar ran, but they did something like that a few years ago. So maybe that's one option. The quote is, if any series has its sights on Long Beach, please tell them to look elsewhere. This is an IndyCar event, and it will be into the future. That sounds pretty clear. Now, you could still invite NASCAR in and just say, you're welcome to come, but you're racing on Saturday. The IndyCar race is the main event. That's what people are used to. This is what has worked well for this event, that we have had date equity for almost 50 years. Next year will be 50, right? This is 49.
Yeah, I believe so.
And people expect an IndyCar event. I also think that audience wants a sports car event. I think NASCAR needs this event more than Long Beach needs NASCAR. This event does fine, thank you very much. What they would like to have about NASCAR is they would like to have that $15 to $20 million, and maybe it's even more in the next contract. That would be the attraction there, is the guaranteed TV money out of that. Some of that goes away with the purse, but there are other things that could be added to that. So it's just something to think about. Now, NASCAR owns IMSA. So if the only way NASCAR can come is kicking out IMSA, that's not helping the overall cause. IMSA really needs to be at Long Beach. There is a car culture there. It's the Acura Grand Prix of Long Beach. Acura races in IMSA. They need to be there. So from the NASCAR standpoint, I'm not sure that they would do that if IMSA had to go. And getting all three of them there is maybe doable. But you're right. It's really, really hard. And there's not many support series there. You know, Indy Lights, Indy Next is not there. They have stadium super trucks. They have usually one other sports car series like Pirelli World Challenge or SRO or something like that that has 18 cars in a very small space that probably is across the street, you know, and then they're driving the cars over to the paddock. But whatever. Awesome news. Fantastic. It seems like every 3 or 4 years in the last 20, we've gotten a little scare. Years ago, it was F1, and plus we've had, what, the Angels wanted to build a stadium there, right? We've had that one come up before.
Yeah, and don't forget our jumpy trucks. Maybe you said that, but
I called them Robbie Gordon Stadium Super Trucks. It's supposed to be properly phrased as the jumpy trucks, and I don't know if they're on the bill this year or not. I hope they are, because they're always one of the most popular. So
I think at Long Beach, after the IndyCar race, I just soon watch the jumpy trucks. They are so good at Long Beach. And if anything, I'd put more jumps in the street circuit. So it's,
if they only brought $15 to $20 million in television revenue.
Exactly.
Unfortunately, they do not.
If they brought that kind of money, they'd be on network TV weekly, because they're so entertaining.
All right, so there's that, done and dusted. So that's good news as we get set to go to Long Beach in the next couple of weeks. When we come back, we'll get into what we learned in testing, hybrid testing, regular testing, oval testing at Texas Motor Speedway. There's still more to unpack from thermal. We'll do that and much more. All coming up, Trackside, 93.5, 107.5 The Fan.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you. Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
This is Alex Palou, and you're listening to Trackside.
Thank you for staying with us as we roll into April and get even closer to more activity with action at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway next week. Long Beach coming up in, where are we at calendar-wise, Kurt? So we are talking 2.5 weeks.
That's
from
right.
Our next points-paying IndyCar race at Long Beach on Sunday, April 21st, with a busy weekend with IMSA also at Long Beach and much more. And then we still have some things we need to talk about with the $1 million challenge at Thermal. And now I'm seeing the strategy even more, and tongue in cheek here a little bit, why this event works so well. One of the reasons that this event was needed was to fill the gap in the calendar. What are we going to do? What are we going to talk about? Well, this exhibition race a week and a half ago is still spurring conversation. So mission accomplished. Yes, a lot of it is angry conversation, but there's still something to be said. But with that, there's still people with constructive criticism and thoughts and, you know, how do we make this better and things along that sense as well. You know, bottom line is that Thermal did help fill a gap in the schedule. We all know that it was far from perfect. I don't think it was the abomination that a lot of people are making it out to be. And my feeling on all of this has always been, I would rather see something, maybe I'm wrong on this, I'd rather see something than nothing. And that was the choice. And we can get into how we got to this place and not Texas not being on the schedule, but some of those things are out of your control too. But you can only deal with the options once the circumstance has been presented to you. So kind of take it in reverse order. Once the Texas race went away, what are we going to do? We're either going to not do anything at all for 6 weeks, or we're going to do this and give it a go. And I'm sure in hindsight, there are things that they would like to have done a little bit differently. Maybe it's because I'm too close to the situation, but I just don't see anything that happened that was all that embarrassing. Unfortunately, we have races that become processional. And I know it was odd when three cars started falling to the back at the beginning. But you know what? That was defeatist. And we kind of debated this, whether you want to do it or not. And the feeling is, well, you can do that and gain some positions, but you're not going to win. You know, you're not going to win from, what was it, 12 in the race? What did we get down to? I've already forgotten. You know, maybe you can go from 12th to first in 20 laps. Maybe. Probably not super likely there either. But you're not going from 12th to first in 10 laps in a track like that. So your best case scenario, and we, I think we even kind of threw this out there, was maybe getting up to, I think we said fourth, fifth, or sixth. And Herta probably did the best that you can do getting up to fourth. And it helped that also a couple of others did not start the final. So he really, he didn't start 12th. He started 10th.
He started 9th, actually, I think, because...
That's right, because he might have started 9th. Because
no Pietro.
Yep.
No Ray Graham. Hall. I think there was one more. But, you know, the point, you can look it up while we're talking here. But, you know, I think it was
Lundgaard. Lundgaard was penalized.
Yeah, all three Ray Hall cars were scheduled to be there and weren't. So, you know, it was, he started 9th and he got to 4th. And that was interesting. You know, it wasn't. I think the problem we have with it is we're thinking that from a purist standpoint, you want to pass people. Well, he did pass people. He just passed people with a strategy that was good. And I haven't baked this idea, but you know, even at a track like Road America, where you don't lose a lap, you know, with pitting, you can do different things. You don't have to, you know, go clear to the front and then, you know, just to protect your position so that when you pit, you won't lose a lap. And there's all kinds of things that happen during the course of a season where there are adjustments like that, but they're not as blatant as this one. And I think that's what rubbed people wrong. And we should have seen it coming. You know, we talked about it. Certainly other people had kicked around the strategy. You know, and the best idea I can come up with for future deals is to do like they do a lot of short track races and just eliminate a car every lap. Whoever's last at the end of every lap, let's just eliminate them. And, you know, you would have gotten rid of Herta and Pietro and we would have, you know, and others along the way.
Or if there's not a guaranteed caution, that also takes out that strategy.
Sure.
You know, if you have the ability to just simply do a pit stop. Now, you know, something I mentioned that the pit box was too small for everyone to pit. Now, this would take a little time. You'd have to make some adjustments. But if you are going to whittle it down to 12 or even 16, those pit boxes could have been big enough. They just were too small for 27 cars to do pit stops, 30 feet or so for each of them. But if you, you know, and you would run the risk of two of the cars to make the final or three of them are all next to each other, how do you spread that out in a made-for-TV event? That's difficult to do. That would be tough to do, to be able to move them, you know, the extra 15 feet and essentially redo pit lane on the fly, because if it takes more than a little bit. But you could also, one of the ideas I had, I don't know if it's a good idea, but it was an idea, is maybe it's not a 2.5 hour TV show. Maybe it's only an hour show and on network TV. And the heat races are on Peacock, and there is a longer gap between them, between the last one, to allow someone to maybe repair the car. And if you had to shuffle the pit lane and to get things reset, and we just come on air, and then plus you have more guaranteed timing. You know, if the heat races run long, no biggie. We weren't on network TV anyway. We have a little wiggle room there.
Well, I don't know why,
if it's an exhibition thing.
I don't know why you'd give up an hour and a half of your TV window if you could have 2.5 hours on NBC. You should take 2.5 hours on NBC, regardless of how it turned out. You should take it.
There's still something I wonder if you could gather in some more people with a shorter event. But we came on the air racing anyway. So
yeah.
I think you're right. You take it. Now, remember, you got it because a race fell out. They had that because of the Texas race. So, you know, hopefully next year you've got all your race dates set. And if this is an extra event, then they may or may not have the window for you. So it all just depends on what the window is. And you might find a circumstance where they say, no, we don't have an extra 2.5 hour network window, but maybe we can find you an hour. It was really odd starting at 9:30 local time. You know, luckily I never adjusted to West Coast time, so I woke up at 4:30 every morning, so I was ready to go. But it, you know, it felt like, and I don't know what it felt like for the other people on site, but it felt like a rain makeup, you know, where we've been there and then it's the next day, let's just come on and finish the thing, and we go on the air and the cars are rolling. There's no pre-race, and you know, sometimes those start at 11 o'clock. I've even been at races where we start at 10 o'clock central time because the window was 11 a.m. Eastern time. That's sort of what the feel was starting that early in the day. So it was really unique, but you know, you do what you need to for the television window. And most of the fans, quote fans, were staying on site. So it's not like it was empty when it started. And people on the West Coast tend to get up early anyway because they do business with the East Coast. And then the whole label of the event, made for TV event, you know, as I talked about last week, what I think made this event good was the at track experience. You know, how ironic or odd was a made for TV event, I would concede, was one of the best fan experiences that were available for some level of investment. Now, I know not everybody has $500, but it costs money to get experiences. Tell me what other sporting event you can go to and get free food and drink and access for $167 a day. The answer is not many, not many. So that's what turned out to be something. And if they were to do it again, I don't know how you can, word is going to spread a little bit.
Yeah.
I don't know that you can do that for $500 again, because if I'm a diehard IndyCar fan, I'm telling you, if that's my goal, that I want selfies and autographs and to be able to talk to people, that goes to P1 on my list. You will not get better access than you would have gotten with that paddock pass.
The only place that I can think of that's even close to that, what you experienced, is Milwaukee, where you're right in the middle of it. If you can get in the infield at Milwaukee, you are close to everybody, but not even that close.
Right.
Not even that close.
Milwaukee's pretty good. But just the amount of people, the fact that it was really, I don't know the number, but I think it was probably somewhere between 200 and 750 what I would call fans. The rest of the people there were millionaires, and they're probably not as interested in getting selfies. So you did not have a lot of competition. I didn't see drivers doing autographs in lines. I saw them in interactions of two and three people at a time. You know, not a whole lot. You really weren't bothering that much because they did not have a long line getting up to them. So that's the advantage that you have, because we have, luckily, events with wonderful access. Milwaukee comes to mind. Road America, the paddock is open. Mid-Ohio, the paddock is open. Is it not? I think it is. Maybe you have to have some sort of a pass, but it is not expensive to get paddock access in Mid-Ohio for IndyCar. I may be getting confused. I think NASCAR, you needed a pass. IndyCar, I don't think you do.
I think that's right. That's right.
There are a few others like that. So anyway, I'm all for doing it again, especially if Thermal is writing a check to IndyCar. And if you have the ability to help the teams in some way, I hadn't read this last week, but I went through the transcript of something. Don Cusick said the test the year before led to five or six members.
Yes.
That makes it a winning event for Thermal. No wonder they decided to do this again. Five or six members at, I forget the number, quarter of a million apiece, plus buying the land.
I think he also said,
which they probably get a cut out of.
He may have said this to you on the Peacock broadcast, but it seems to me he said he got more than a couple of his Indy 500 partners out of that test as well.
Okay.
So that was profitable for his Indy 500 program as well. That's the kind of thing that I thought would trickle down to the teams, that they would meet somebody with a lot of money who, if you did an Indy 500 program on the high end for $1.5 million and somebody dropped $300,000 on you, that's a helpful piece of assets that you could pick up from an event like this, that those kind of people aren't running around at Mid-Ohio or at Road America. No disrespect.
Harder to find. There's not as many of them.
Correct.
Question from Paul. With Thermal not being a points race, wouldn't the racing be more exciting if you split the money, gave half to those that qualified in the top six, then reversed the grid and gave the other half to the top six winners of the main race?
The point is, I think you could do a lot of different ways with distributing money. And, I wouldn't say it's unfortunate, but it was, it would have been nice if it could have paid, deeper down into the field, so that 7th and 8th and 9th and 10th, making the feature would have been more beneficial, because right now 6th place and making the feature was no different than finishing last in the heat race. But, you can tweak a lot of those kind of details. I think ultimately the only issue that we saw really is track's pretty big. It's difficult with 12 cars on the racetrack and a track that's 3-something miles long. I mean, that you can get spread out. And and from a viewing standpoint, by the way, I found it very difficult, having not been to the Thermal Club, to know where I was at and where cars were at. I guess I should say more, was this turn 12 or am I in 16? Am I in 8? Landmarks.
I bet. So now you're seeing what the typical viewer and fan deals with, because this is the only race you've ever watched outside of, maybe ever. Maybe there's an international event.
A few kart races that I didn't go to.
But you get my point. You've been to every single track that they race at, so you know what the track is. So now it's good for us to do that sometimes. Now we know what the average fan is thinking about, is that I feel confused. I don't know where it's at. That's a point to the broadcast that, maybe we need to use the telemetry more that shows where the leader is, the marching ants, that shows where they're at on the track, to pop that in a little bit more to help people learn where things are at. And some may say, it doesn't really matter, because there are tracks that I know that I can't tell at first glance whether that's turn 6, turn 11. I don't necessarily have them. Some of them I have memorized, some of them I don't.
Well, St. Pete is one. Like I do, at least I've always tried to emphasize at St. Pete, if you're going to pay attention, you want to pay attention to turn four and turn 10. Those are the two passing zones of significance, a hard right-hander and a hard left-hander. And you try to, through your writing or your distributing of information, really focus on those two areas of the racetrack. The rest of them are, a lot of them are all visuals that you can see. And St. Pete, we've been going to for obviously for a long time. I think it will come with time at Thermal, but I just had trouble again, because I hadn't been there. And this is what the fan goes through. Where are the passing zones? Where are the places when you say he's coming up on turn 17? Okay, my antenna goes up. That's a passing zone. And I think that's the track.
Maybe there
is
weren't
big.
A lot of them.
I understand that. And I'm sure the punchline is played for effect right there. But
although Colton heard a pass some people,
yeah,
there was some overtaking. And if you had different tire life, I think you would see passing. So here's the options for next year moving forward. Well, one, it starts with, is Thermal or someone willing to write you a nice sanctioning check again? That's where it starts. You have to have the money. If you get to that point, then I think IndyCar has a couple of options. Maybe ideally, it's, can we find another event, a good event, for late March, early April? If we can, then let's make Thermal a preseason event, and it can continue to be some sort of an exhibition or whatever, and we can tweak and we can experiment and do other things. But if they cannot find an event to go between St. Pete and Long Beach, then this should become a points event. And then it's, how do we figure out a way to create the pit space available or do something creative there to make that work? Because at this time in the calendar, I think most of us would agree, there's no reason to do an exhibition in race two. If it's viable, let's just do a regular championship event. And then we don't have to present the thing so differently and talk about all the homes. And, you know, maybe that was presented the wrong way. We don't know the magic answer to those things. We came up with what we thought people might be interested in. Obviously, a lot of people get really angry when they are confronted with the massive wealth of some other people. So, okay. Now, some people probably enjoyed it. They just didn't message us on Twitter.
Well,
but, you know, point taken. So if it's a championship points race, we're probably not going to send Townsend out around to the facility because we need him to analyze the race because it really matters.
I would say if the Thermal Club was a sponsor of the event, then that's fine to do that, you know.
Well, we're going to need to do it at some point, yeah, because it's no different than any other. It's no different than what you do for Hy-Vee or for Chevrolet or Honda or Firestone. You know, you're doing what you can to make the business work in that regard. And my respect as a consumer, I'm okay with that. I'm okay with whoever paid the bill getting something for their money in that standpoint. It's why we watch commercials. That's just part of the business. I'd really not rather see commercials, but I understand if I want something mostly free or at a discount at my viewing pleasure. I know nothing is really free anymore. Even free TV is not fully free. You're still paying someone to get that free TV unless you have the old-fashioned antenna, which not many of us have. So I get it. The money has to flow in some respects to someone. So
I don't know that we thought about the Thermal Club being a sponsor. You know, and I'm usually very in tune with those things. The Firestone.
I don't know
Grand
that
100%,
but it sure makes sense to me.
Sure makes sense to me too. I hadn't really thought about it going in, and that probably. And ultimately, the biggest thing is your content is driven by what's new. What's new in the content to talk about? And the newness on this particular trip was what you could see with your own eyes, which was very expensive property.
A couple more tweets and we'll get you set for hour number two next on Trackside.
Hi, this is Colton Herta, and you're listening to Trackside on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
Okay, before we get to hour number two, let's sneak in a couple more tweets from Lynn, formerly the Spurs fan. Was the NASCAR Long Beach story overhyped? Was there ROFR between the owners, Kevin and Gerald? You'll have to help me on ROFR. Any idea there?
No, I'm just...
Text your daughter. She's in her 20s. Maybe she would know.
She's not. She's in her 30s now.
Well, she's got a better chance than us.
Yeah.
Maybe my daughter. Was it overhyped? I don't think so. No, this was a big deal. And if there was a chance that it was going to get sold to NASCAR, that's not good. You know, I still held out a lot of hope that somehow Roger Penske was going to stay involved. And I think if it came down to it, if Jerry Forsyth said, I'm selling it to the highest bidder, I think Penske Entertainment might have decided we need to be the highest bidder. And then that's where Forsyth and maybe the Cal Coven, I don't know who's running that estate, if there's any connection there, but they might have helped him out there. And I think he could have made that money work because he could have just simply invited NASCAR. NASCAR needs a Southern California race. Fontana is a long way away from happening. The Coliseum is not a great place to have certainly a points-paying race. I don't know what their other options are at this point. You've apparently found out what ROFR means. Can we not say it?
It's just right of first refusal. I was I was looking for something trendy and young like you were and skipped right over that one.
So Lynn is a business person. Yeah, right of first refusal. Was there that between the owners? Maybe. Yeah, that makes sense. In most relationships like that, if it's 50-50, even if it's not, yeah, the partners would normally get the first opportunity to match any sale price out there. So that would make some sense.
But clearly there was some things happening, swirling, that would lead you to believe that wasn't going to happen.
Frank asks, speaking about Texas out of the schedule, you talked about money, money, money. Is there someone who reminds to others that this track was in every season since 1997 and hosted most races in the IRL era? If money is the only reason, Penske and TMS must be starving. Well, from 97 to about when? 2007, 2008, there was plenty of money coming in because the grandstands were full. But you raise a question that a lot of us had that we don't know how that was working. How was Texas making money off of that event, especially in the last 10 years, when there were somewhere between 8,000 and 25,000 people there, depending on who you want to ask and who is doing the counting? My theory was always that they had sponsorship deals for signage on the walls.
Yes.
It said we have to have three major events. So that was if you want to call it a loss leader, is that the proper phrase? I don't know. But I think or speculate that the money that they were bringing in from the NASCAR races, that they just simply for those sponsors, they needed to have a third, quote, major event. And that's where IndyCar came in and other things along with that, including Eddie Gossage liked IndyCar. He still hoped to make it work. And even when there's 8,000 people there or 15,000 or whatever, there's still revenue. There's money in the motorsport business because there's an awful lot of motorsport events that don't have spectators. So how do you think they work? Well, the paddock is paying for things. You know, camping sites are expensive. Credentials are expensive. Everything. The drivers are paying for things. There's money that we're not really thinking of that comes into play. So in that standpoint, you know, it may have been if we can just come close to breaking even, maybe it's good enough. You're right. Money isn't the only thing, but it's a lot of the thing. And if the money was there, they would have figured out something. But from the IndyCar side of things, in my opinion, I should have included one more thing. It's not just about the money for wanting that event to continue. It should also be about the perception.
Yes.
And IndyCar needed to think, is this how we want to be perceived on national TV, cable TV, or anything else? Is this good for our brand when we race in front of 85% empty grandstands? I'm guesstimating that number. Maybe I'm off by a few percent, but you get what I'm saying. It looked empty. That cannot be good for your brand. I contend that unless something was going to change, IndyCar should not race there. and racing at 11 a.m. local time on a Sunday, it is not going to change. If that is the time slot you are offered, IndyCar, I'll say it, should not race at Texas Motor Speedway.
Too strong? Agree with all that. You know, in those early years of racing at Texas, you know, it wasn't full, by the way, your words there, but it certainly looked...
There were a decent amount of people there.
Yeah. There was a decent amount of people there, and it looked proper. And I think ultimately, I mean, you would never say that high-speed oval racing, you know, should be done in front of a certain number of people, eyeballs, time slot, whatever. But to go and do the kind of racing that we've seen on a high-speed oval with so few people is probably not in the best interest of the sport either. You know, you want to put on a good show, but 11 o'clock with a time slot and not many people in attendance, you start to have pushback from your constituents.
And I'm not blaming the start time on the track. Might have wanted something too, but if it was decided this has to be on network television from a business perspective, and then the network only offers you 11 a.m. local, noon Eastern time, 12:30, whatever the case may be, then that's not a great option. I still hold out hope something can happen there, but it needs to be very different than the template that we've seen the last few years. Agreed. Running it back again in early April at 11:30 does not work. So let's see what else we can do there. I got more tweets we'll get to a little bit later on. We still have to discuss who did well on track at Thermal, and many other things to get to coming up on Trackside.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
Hi, this is David Malukas, and you're listening to Trackside.
Okay, wanted to sneak in a couple of more Twitter, Xbox questions before we get into some news. I like this question from No, I'm Not That Guy at the Moon Corp. He said, what do you think of a Survivor type of TV series where drivers could compete in different racing challenges for a chance at an Indy 500 seat? The 100 Days to Indy in DTS format have been done, and something like this could help draw attention to IndyCar. Essentially a televised gong show. You know, you get someone that is, gong show is what they used to call, you know, when teams with budget, with a funded seat, would bring out four or five drivers, and you do a test day, and whoever's the fastest gets the seat. And that is the way it used to work. And it still works to some extent. Jagger Jones, one of Jackson's buddies, that's how he got his first LMP3 seat last year. It was essentially funded by the team. Several young drivers went to a test. Jagger was the best. He got to do the race, and he was awesome in the race. I think that would be cool if you could get somebody to pay for it and offer a subsidized seat.
I agree. You'd have to, you know, see how it comes together. It's not a whole lot different than how Elio Castroneves and Tony Kanaan got the seat.
Exactly.
I mean, they were the fastest too, and they got the seats. So
Allmendinger, I know, has told me stories about how early in his career he had some opportunities like that. You know, that's certainly what Red Bull was doing back in the day. But from a business development standpoint, you know, if you could, that's the combination there. That's your primary sponsor is on this show, that if you could get it sold to a Netflix or something like that, and you're doing a whole program and it's not just about who's the fastest, like the Team USA scholarship, but times 10. And instead of going to the Formula Ford Festival, you know, you're dealing with drivers that have the credentials and the background. So they're Indy Next drivers. Maybe they're Colin Browns. Maybe they're Tom Blomqvist. Maybe they're people, you know, it's Spencer Pigot, people who've been out of a seat. Oliver Askew, all of that. Let's bring them all together. Let's get it done.
Stephen Wilson.
Exactly. Anyone that is comparable, that is capable of driving a car, and then you're also, you know, testing their off-track skills, have them do commercials. You could have fun with that. All the outtakes from them trying to do public appearances and things like that. Yeah, that'd be great. Now, easier said than done, because somebody's got to pay for it. And it would cost you more than just the, you know, $8 million for the seat for next year. Because generally speaking, I'd love to know the business standpoint of how IndyCar got this Netflix thing done. You know, maybe the hardest part is the production cost, because everything I had heard up before last year, when anyone talked to someone affiliated with IndyCar about making a non-scripted, how do we phrase these again? Non-scripted documentary.
You're close.
Yeah, whatever. They wanted cash because they're expensive to produce. So you had to get that funded. Now, this is a ready-made hand you series. So I don't know what the financials are. If IndyCar or someone, maybe the producer had to pay to be on there. Does Netflix pay, or is it a barter system and it's zero and it's based on the number of views that it gets? Probably a combination of all those in between, but that's probably half the battle. If you can get someone else to produce it, it's a lot easier to get a program on Amazon or Netflix or Hulu. The hardest part is what, you know, Formula One did. It may not be produced by Netflix either. That may be a production company that has sold it to Netflix, but someone had to front the cost for that.
It's just like me helping to fund Cherry Bomb, which you asked me about a few weeks ago, and I couldn't think what the name of my son's miniseries was called. Cherry Bomb. Go looking for it. It's all one word, Cherry Bomb. So
okay,
you can find that on your various Amazon Primes.
Looking through the Twitter inbox, I'm seeing some pictures of the Easter egg hunt. We had David Malukas there at the White House yesterday, so that's good. IndyCar's been able to do that the last couple of years, and Lynn underscore IndyCar sent pictures along of the Parkside cards. So I'm out of the demographic on that, but I can tell that's been a hit with the audience on social media, that these are basically, you know, I would call them baseball cards. They're trading cards for IndyCar drivers. And then apparently some of them actually have real life signatures on there. So
any question of whether I shouldn't say it, whether David Malukas was confused as one of the participants. He's so young
thing.
Looking.
He looked like he probably would have been asked to go get in line. Good for him. You know, there's going to become a point in time we all wish we all looked that young. Okay, so in the last week or so, we had some testing. We'll mention at Texas Motor Speedway, some of the young fellas got a chance to get some oval opportunities. Kiffin Simpson with a shakedown from Alex Palou. Christian Rasmussen, Ed Carpenter in the car for a few laps. And Nolan Siegel as well, getting his first big oval lap. So that's good. And then we had a lot of people at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, some in hybrids, some that have already done the hybrids. Namely, that's what? Penske, Ganassi, Andretti, and McLaren. So everybody else got their first go in a hybrid. And so that's work for the teams. I assume most of them have to change their regular car over to the hybrid car. There aren't extra chassis at this point. So that'll be something we talk with drivers about as we move forward on that front as well. So it's certainly a negative that Penske and Ganassi, they're going to be better at this and more prepared when this happens in July. But one advantage these other teams maybe get is they got, especially for young drivers, some track time at a track they're going to race at. Can they learn anything for the Grand Prix? Because some of those teams did not have to burn the IMS test day. They took it at Barber a couple of weeks. Maybe that is a help. Maybe not, because so much of it is about the tire. And when it's a different weight, I don't know how much it's applicable other than a new driver getting laps at that track.
Well, and this isn't what you're asking, but to some degree it is. Rinus VK, for example, spoke of how he was basically shaking things down on the first day of the hybrid test at the Speedway so that his teammate, Christian Rasmussen, could have a better day the second day. So from Rinus VK's standpoint, he didn't get much accomplished. He was learning the lingo, talking it over with his engineer, but largely helping make sure the car was ready to go for Christian Rasmussen. Now, Rinus VK doesn't need days in the car at the Speedway on the road course to be pretty good. He's won a race there. He's won a pole there. But to your point, not all of that time was just spent, you know, getting ready for usage with the hybrid. Some of it was just making sure things work the way they're supposed to work.
I've been teasing this for a long time, so we need to go back and do it. From thermal, who gained the most? Who impressed us the most? What was really positive. And I'll allow you time to pull up a box score if you need it. You know, I think we're both going to agree that Nolan Siegel did something really nice. You know, almost advancing out of the first heat race, finishing, he finished, what, seventh, just missed the transfer spot in what is really his first IndyCar weekend. That was awesome.
That was awesome. I thought Rinus VK showed really well out of the box. I actually went back because I thought his start to this season was one of his better ones, and yet he's actually statistically at least fared better at St. Pete than he did this year. But it felt like at St. Pete and then again at Thermal that he was in at a pretty competitive situation. So I felt good about Rinus, and he spoke of that as well. But Nolan Siegel's one that clearly comes to mind. I think, you know, Alex Palou certainly sent the shot across the bow as let's get too hung up on Joseph Newgarden dominating St. Pete, because really, and I think you mentioned it last week, Palou was just a couple laps on that first pit stop at St. Pete to being right in the mix with the overcut. So he was probably better at St. Pete than even when he finished sixth. So
I think Rosenquist really backed up St. Pete by being quick all weekend, finishing third in the final. McLaughlin was solid all weekend. I think Marcus Armstrong had a good weekend. Finishing sixth was important for Linus Lundqvist. Canapino was strong. That also comes to mind there. Of those that did, I thought Colin Brown did some nice things, an important weekend for him to learn. And there may be, you know, and then there's some others. The Andretti cars were not nearly as strong as they were last year. They are happy that was not a points race in that circumstance. And then Callum Ilott looked like he was going to qualify up front. They got a last lap. He went from potential pole to starting sixth or seventh. I think it was still an okay weekend. That's one of the questions. I do not know. I have not seen confirmation. Is Malukas racing at Long Beach? Ilott is not available. If it's not Malukas, I do not know who it is at this point. That is a TBD.
Coming up, we talk Bill Vukovic, new book out that's been in the works for a long time, with Mark Monteith on Trackside.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
Hi, this is Joseph Newgarden, and you're listening to Trackside.
Thank you for staying with us as we continue to talk about what's going on right now. Let's talk history a little bit, but it's certainly applicable. We are into April. It's not May yet, but it's real close, because in April, in some ways, that starts off the month of May, because we'll have cars on track next week for the official two-day test on the 10th and 11th at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, prepping for the 108th Indianapolis 500, and a chance for some of us learn about someone we probably know a little bit about. If you don't know anything about him, you need to. And then there may be a few that even saw him race. The legendary Bill Vukovic, who won back-to-back 500s in 53 and 54 and coulda, woulda, shoulda won four in a row from 52 to 55 before he was tragically killed in a crash in 55. Well, there's a new book out that is, 60-some years in the making. Started in the late 50s and essentially finished not long ago by our next guest, Mark Monteith, longtime writer for the Indianapolis Star, now contributes to IBJ as a freelance writer, very recognizable to our Indianapolis audience. Covered the Pacers for many years, covered IU, Purdue, spent a lot of time out at the Speedway and pretty much everything else in between. Mark, how are you? It's great to chat with you.
Great to be with you, Kevin. It's been a while.
Yeah, it has. So this is a good excuse. When I heard about this, I think I saw it. Maybe you posted something on social media a couple of months ago. I said, well, we need to talk about this on the show. So I'm going to let you explain this. This is not your typical biography. The book, by the way, is called Vukovic, The Man Who Wouldn't Lift, and it is available now. Tell me how this all came together and how you got involved.
Yeah, quite a story how it came together. You know, I had, first of all, become kind of familiar with the work of Angelo Angelopoulos in other research. He was the sports writer for the Indianapolis News, a 1936 Manual High School graduate, a 1940 Butler graduate, and was a sports writer throughout the 40s and 50s for the News. And his talent really jumped out at me. I thought, boy, this guy's good. You know, he just was a little bit different than everybody else. So over the years, I kind of researched him a little bit and became more familiar with him. And then last year, happened kind of by happenstance to learn that he had written a book. I knew he had done this book on Bill Vukovich that never got published, but I didn't realize there was still a manuscript for it. And I was talking with Angelo's nephew, Pete Curlis, of the Curlis Jewelry Store.
Okay.
And he said he had the manuscript in his closet. So I was really curious. It had been gathering dust there for I don't know how long Pete had had it, but this book was supposed to come out in spring of 1960. Angelo had a contract with a local book publisher, Bob's Merrill, to bring this book out in the spring of 1960. But for whatever reason, it did not happen. So I learned about this manuscript in Pete Curlis's closet and got a hold of it, looked at it, and it was a mess. You know, a lot of handwritten edits, a lot of things crossed out. But I could tell that there was something there. There was just something there. And knowing Angelo's talent, I was really intrigued by it and just thought it's pretty cool if I could get a book out that was supposed to come out in 1960 and never did. My wife deserves a lot of credit because she's the one who took that double space manuscript and typed it in word for word into a laptop computer.
Oh, wow.
So that I could begin the editing process. I think that's what has scared people off. A lot of people, Robin Miller, other racing people, had their hands on that manuscript over the years, but nobody wanted to really do anything with it because it was intimidating. It was such a mess. So my wife, to her credit, she typed it in. And from there, we began editing, going through it. I ignored some of the things he crossed out and put them back in. I tried to read his handwriting as best I could. In some cases, I couldn't. I rearranged some chapters because he kind of went back and forth with present tense being 1955 and going back. I just kind of went chronologically after I introduced the 1955 race at the beginning of the book. But otherwise, you know, it's his book. It was a heavy edit in a sense, but it's not like I rewrote it. You know, he was too talented for that. And what I did do, though, in the meantime, was write a lengthy prologue on Angelo, because he's got a tragic story of his own. You know, he was a pilot in World War II. And from flying over the bombing sites in Japan, contracted leukemia. The radiation from the bombing sites, he got leukemia. He was diagnosed in 1955 and very gradually withered away and died in October of 1962. I don't think that's why the book didn't get published, though, because he was still writing for the Indianapolis News up until September of 1962. So, again, I don't think that's the reason. But Angelo had a story that should be told. And then I wrote a lengthy epilogue on Vukovich because the book ends with Vukovich dying in the 1955 race. I wanted to bring that all up to date, talk about what happens to his wife after this accident. What happened? What about his son, Bill Jr.? Then, of course, there was Billy Vukovich III, who was killed in a sprint car practice lap accident in 1990. So a lot of things to bring up to date. So it became a major, major project that took up most of my summer and fall. But I feel really good about it. I'm glad I did it. And Angelo and Vukovich both deserve to have this book out.
Well, and I think race fans, this and just the legacy of Bill Vukovich. I'm sure there are other works on Bill Vukovich, but nothing recently. So that's why it's needed. And you mentioned the work. Go ahead.
Yeah, you probably know Bob Gates. You know, Bob Gates wrote a book on Vukovich in around 2003. And I want to give Bob credit because he had done a very different type of book on Vukovich in around 2003 or four, and he could have resented my efforts to do another one, even though it was previously written. But he was very helpful. He loaned out photographs to me and gave me some background information and some phone numbers. So I give Bob Gates a lot of credit for his assistance on my project.
Yeah, I should have looked in my behind me here in my little library. I bet that book is up here somewhere.
Yeah, probably.
And it's, you know, that's just an aside. I used to read books
And then the internet came about, and I can't keep up with the internet. I'm going to get this one done, though. I just started over the weekend, and I'm going to say I am about a fourth of the way in, and I'm enjoying it very much. I read another book. I finished a Jim Thorpe biography that came out a couple of years ago, a few weeks ago. So I'm going to try to get a few in a year and be like a normal person once again. So in the editing process, my first thought in what would take you so long is, yes, Angelo Angelopoulos was a fantastic writer in the 1950s, but I assumed that the phrasings and the stylings and the wording was different. How much of that did you have to change, or was good writing in 1959? Is it still good writing today and you didn't have to change very much?
Yeah, it pretty much was the same. Now, I did make some changes, like Vukovic and his wife, Esther, when they were here for the month of May, stayed with a family on 15th Street in Speedway, a big house. And I got a picture of that house in the book. Lawrence and Dorcas Thompson. Lawrence Thompson was the principal of Speedway Schools. And but Angelo referred to Mrs. Thompson as Mrs. Lawrence Thompson. Well, you know, today we give the women a first name, right? So she becomes Dorcas Thompson in the book. I made changes like that. But otherwise, there weren't a whole lot of changes. There were some things along those lines to kind of accommodate the progress we've made in certain social issues. But otherwise, you know, his writing still holds up. You know, he was just a talented guy. And, you know, as a writer for an afternoon newspaper, he would have had time in his stories to think about it. You know, he wasn't always on deadline like the morning newspaper guys were. So that part of it held up. But I just made a few changes to acknowledge the changes in society, basically.
Mark Monteith is joining us, longtime Indianapolis writer with the Indianapolis Star, now with IBJ and other outlets. The book is called Vukovic, The Man Who Wouldn't Lift, by Angelo Angelopoulos. And officially, how are we phrasing it? That you edited the book?
Yeah, I'm the editor and publisher. You know, I have my own little publishing arm, Half Court Press, and I paid for the printing and everything else. And I have a distributor who will get it to Amazon and into the retail outlets, but I'm the editor and publisher.
We need to sell some of these then.
We do need to sell some, absolutely. Yeah,
we're going to try to help you.
Your comment about, you know, the internet, there's no doubt about it. People don't read books like they used to, and I suppose I'm guilty too, but I try to make it a point to always have one in progress. But attention spans have shrunk, and when you write a sports-related book, you're basically trying to appeal to men. And men, you know, aren't as likely to sit down and read a book as women are, I don't believe. I'll tell you that at least this book has a lot of pictures in it. There's more than 40 photographs. You could look through the pictures, if nothing else. A lot of pictures of Vukovic and other people. But
well, one is one of the classic pictures on the bench in the garage. Is that from 53, one of the really hot 500s?
Yeah, the 53 race was the hottest ever, but the photograph is actually from the 54 race, and that's often misidentified.
Okay.
But yeah, that, you know, I purchased photographs from the Speedway's Photoshop, and they told me that that photograph, which is on the back cover and inside the book, is the most purchased photograph they have. Of all the pictures, the thousands upon thousands of photographs you could buy from the Speedway's Photoshop over at the museum building, that is the one most pictured. And it's a dramatic photo. It's after a win, but he's clearly exhausted.
So in your research and from talking to as close to contemporaries as you can get and other people that knew of him, and really just reading what Angelopoulos wrote about him 5 years after the fact, what do you gather made, and I haven't gotten to this part in the book, I'm up to like 1952, what made him special? What separated him to the point where many think he's the greatest ever at that race?
Yeah, he was, to pardon and use a pun, I guess, a driven guy. He grew up poor, one of eight kids in California, kind of a grapes of wrath existence, you know, on a farm. Tragic childhood. His father committed suicide when he was like 13, 14 years old. So grew up in very challenging circumstances, and that kind of created his personality. And he was just a tough guy, and he was just stronger and tougher and more courageous than other drivers. You know, as you know, back in that era in the 50s, you didn't run flat out all the way around the track. You know, the cars didn't handle like today. So You know, the subtitle is The Man Who Wouldn't Lift, because that's a reference to Vukovic stayed on the throttle longer into the turns than other drivers did. And he could do that because he was one stronger. He was always gripping hand devices to strengthen his hands and wrists, and he was braver. So that gave him an advantage. That made him better than the others. Of course, he also had great equipment, and he was fortunate to get with a great group of mechanics and ownership. So he had top of the line equipment for that era, but he was just a better driver. You know, he, as you mentioned, he should have been a four-time winner. He had the race won in 1952 with eight laps to go, and a cotter pin on his steering wheel, about a 50-cent part, broke, so he couldn't turn the wheel, and so he was slid into the wall. Would have won that race. He won it easily in 53 and 54, and he was winning it in 55 when he was swept up in a backstretch accident that took his life. So without any good luck, just the absence of tragic luck, he would have won four in a row, and who knows, he might have come back in 1956 and won again. I mean, if you could imagine, if the 500 had a driver who won four consecutive races, what a legend that driver would be. The four-time winners are on a pedestal, of course, but none of them won more than two in a row. So the legend Bill Vukovic could be is just astounding if he just had not had this tragic luck.
It was a different era for drivers. What was life like outside of May for someone like Bill Vukovic in the 1950s? What else did he do? How much did he race? You know, I've read up into the 40s, he's racing as much as he can to maybe make $1,000 a year. What about once he made the big time?
Yeah, once he started winning in Indy, he backed off from the sprint and champ car circuits, didn't do very many of those races, but that's how he cut his teeth, so to speak. You know, he grew up in California on those tracks, the dirt tracks, and like he said himself, you know, he met every piece of dust and every flying rock on the Hamburger Trail and earned his stripes. But once he got established and was making some money, he backed off of that. And he was a regular guy. He owned a couple of gas stations in Fresno, and he worked there himself. He would pump gas. You could drive into his gas station, and a two-time winner of the Indianapolis 500 might come out and pump your gas. I've seen a picture on Facebook that his granddaughter posted of him pumping gas. He also was a mechanic. So, you know, I heard a story once where somebody came up to get gas and he was busy working on someone's car. And he told him, go down the street and buy your gas there. I'm busy. You know, I mean, he was just a down-to-earth guy, a good father and husband to his wife, devoted to his family. And, you know, by the time the 55 race came around, he was growing tired of it, and it looked like it might be his last race. And there was a real possibility he was just going to go back to Fresno and run those gas stations and enjoy life in other ways. But it didn't happen. But he was just to me, you know, Kevin, he reminds me of Larry Bird. He grew up under tragic circumstances with a father who committed suicide. He was poor. And he was a blunt, hard ass kind of guy, but had a real sense of humor about him and was a genuine guy, low ego guy. As famous as he was a low ego guy. And people, once they got to know him, gravitated to that. You know, he wouldn't be the guy glad handing people, didn't like attention or publicity. He would try to avoid the media, although he became really close friends with Angelo Angelopoulos. But he was Larry Bird like in his personality and approach to his fame. And like I said, once people understood that and got to know him, they really respected him.
I could see that from what I've read and what I know of Larry Bird. Doesn't understand why people want so much of him. Why do you want to talk to me? I'm just another guy. And that's kind of what I gather from your book about Vukovic. Didn't get what all the fuss was about and why everyone wanted to shake his hand. Now, you got into something I was going to ask you about, because the book basically starts with the morning of the 55 race and him appearing to treat it a little bit differently with how he left the house and greeted his wife and talking to other people. So I haven't gotten to the follow-up to that, but was there a sense that he was thinking, maybe I've tempted fate long enough, or I'm ready to move on to something else?
Yeah, throughout the book, there are these omens, just the indication that he feels this 1955 race might be different. And yeah, like you said, maybe he's going to press his luck one too many times. And he's talking about how he doesn't have the same enthusiasm for it. And there are indications that there is impending danger in this race. And his wife feels that too. So you could sense that something's going to happen here. You know, he just felt that. And there's a bit of a cloud hanging over him and his wife heading into that race. But, you know, the race begins and he takes the lead and he's got it under control. And the other guy who was supposed to be his primary contender, Jack McGrath, has dropped out and everything's looking great. They're all set up to win another one. And then lo and behold, there's this accident on the backstretch outside of his control that claims his life.
Well, I'm greatly looking forward to finishing this and think I will finish it before the week is over. Kurt said he finished it and it was excellent. So let's let other people find out where to get it. What's the best way?
Well, you can get it on Amazon.com. That's one of the easiest ways. It will be in the Barnes & Nobles here in town. If it's not there now, it will be there soon. I just got it back from the printer like early last week. So it's a new book, but it, you know, may not be everywhere yet, but it should be in the usual retail book outlets. You can get it directly from me. I feel awkward, Kevin, signing copies of the book because I didn't write it. But if somebody does want a signature for my part in it, I'm happy to do it. If you can reach me on Facebook or Twitter or any other way, you know, there is a post office box number for my publishing company that you can send money to, and I'll be happy to mail a book out personally to people. So for people who are in touch with me on social media, that's an option too, but certainly Amazon or the usual retail book outlets.
And it looks like markmonteith.com. Is there a contact you off of that?
Yeah, you can reach me off of my website, markmonteith.com, a lot of other things on that website. And I might add, Kevin, on April 27th, I'll be doing an appearance at the Curlis Jewelry Store on 86th Street to sign books and kind of tell the story of the book. Pete Curlis will be there. This couldn't happen without him hanging on to that manuscript all these years, so he deserves credit. So that'll be an opportunity as well for people perhaps to buy a copy on Saturday, April 27th, I think from 1 to 4 at the Curlis Jewelry Store on West 86th Street around the Ditch Road area.
Awesome. Here's another invite. The Burger Bash, Monday, May 20th. We haven't fully announced this, so this is our first hint of this, and we're going to have details of what this all entails and exactly where it's at when we announce it next week on the show. But you're welcome to come by and, you know, kind of hang out with us. And if anybody wants one there, that might be a good audience for you.
I would be happy to do that, Kevin, May 20th.
Right. Yep. I can't say where, because we're going to announce where coming up on next week's show and what all is entailed. So that's a teaser for just kind of a save the date that I had kind of thought about doing tonight on the program anyway. So markmonteith.com, MONTIETH.com, available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble soon. Vukovic, The Man Who Wouldn't Lift, Angelo Angelopoulos, and Mark Monteith. Mark, it's great to catch up with you. We'll look forward to reading about Purdue and IBJ this coming Friday. That's a lot of fun. We've got local basketball still to watch for the weekend and much more coming up. Thanks, Mark. Talk to you soon.
Hey, thank you, Kevin. Appreciate it.
Stay with us. We'll see what we missed and more coming up next on Trackside.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
Hi, this is Kyle Kirkwood, and you're listening to Trackside.
Final segment, IndyCar off this weekend, but we do have other racing, Formula One in Japan, so different hours, late night Thursday first practice. The race is late Saturday night, really very early Sunday morning, like 1 or 2 in the morning, so I'll see it at my convenience on Sunday morning. NASCAR in Martinsville, no IndyCar, but USF Juniors, USF 2000, Pro 2000 at NOLA this weekend, with triple headers. You can find those on YouTube, and then we'll be back at it next week. We'll talk Monday night at 7 o'clock about the IMS Open Test and more. One more tweet. Joseph Hall says, I've asked this a couple of times, who put up the money for thermal? And I sort of answered this the best of my ability a couple of times. I believe it is thermal. I don't know that for certain. Those things aren't always disclosed, but that's my best guess and the best guess of others as well. We're out of time. We'll see you next Monday night. Thanks for joining us on Trackside, 93.5, 107.5 The Fan.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.